And now it is my great pleasure to start this conference introducing to you our keynote speaker, Margaret Olin. Teaches visual theory, photography theory and history, visual culture and Jewish visual studies at Yale University. Prior to her appointment at Yale in 2009, she was professor in the departments of art history, theory and criticism, and visual and critical studies at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. Her interests include Jewish spatial practices, theories of perception, and the theory and practice of visual witnessing. Besides a long list of essays and articles, she is the author of three books: Forms of Representation in Alois Riegel's Theory of Art, 1992, The Nation Without Art, Examining Modern Discourses in Jewish Art, 2001, and Touching Photographs, appeared in 2012, and I will come back on this book later on. With Robert Nelson, she edited Monuments and Memory, Made and Unmade, 2003, and with Stephen Fine and Maya Balakirskatz, she edits the journal Images, a journal of Jewish art and visual culture. Margaret Olin is also a practicing photographer, whose photographic work plays a fundamental role in her scholarship, which is expressed, among others, in the subtitle of her blog, Touching Photographs, that is, Thinking With and About Photographs. Currently, she is engaged in a study of photography and imagination and in several ongoing projects on visual culture and photographic practices in Israel and Palestine. A selection from one of these photographic projects, Marking Time, Photographs from Daishi Refugee Camp 2014-16, was shown in Paderborn, Germany in 2016. In 2012, she curated the multi-venue exhibition Shaping Community, Poetics and Politics of the Eruv at Yale University, to which she contributed the photographic installations Urban Bricolage and No Carry Zone. Some of this concern can be followed on the already mentioned blog, Touching Photographs, which in her own words, I quote, represents my efforts to comprehend the practices and powers of photography through words and images, end of quote. Let me say some more words on her book, Touching Photographs, which is particularly relevant for the topic of our conference. Here, Margaret Olin analyzes the tactile presence of photographs, introducing the concept of tactile looking. Olin turns to Merleau-Ponty to note that perception is always relational. Photography is always connected to a gesture. From making to viewing, I quote, gestures turn photographs into presences that populate the world like people and act within it to connect people, end of quote. Photographs are physical objects that are touched, but they also touch us and help us establish interpersonal relationships. Especially her rereading of Roland Barthes' Camera Lucida suggests that the indexical power of photography resides not so much in the relationship between the photograph and its subject, but in the relationship between the photograph and its viewer or user, what Olin calls the performative index. Photographic practices give form to communities, and this focus on the life of communities is a leitmotif also in her own photographic projects. As she states in her blog, I quote, "In the end, it is the real world that counts." And I think this is a good motto for our conference and a convenient introduction to her keynote. Margaret, we are grateful that you accepted our invitation.
Costanza, thank you for that great introduction. I have only touched on migration in my work, in passing, literally passing, considering the meaning of the word migration, ways. But I'm presumptuous enough to think that perhaps what I am thinking about will be very easily translatable, or at least hopefully translatable, to the issue of migration, or at least to migrants and those who deal with them. In fact, my discussion might be more easily applicable to people involved in migration than in migration itself as some kind of a global word applied to all kinds of activities. And just something about my title here, I've given a lot of different titles. I decided finally to just to take the word migration out of my title and make it more applicable to what I'm going to say. The title, as well as the talk itself, is a kind of free-flowing first attempt to deal with some of the issues that, as Costanza just mentioned, are in the background of my blog. I'm going to start with naming. It's a kind of hesitation about words. This past week, I was teaching Camus' The Plague for the upteenth time. I noticed that this time that the narrator, a doctor, does not want to call the epidemic the plague. He says in a group of doctors discussing what to do about what's happening in the town, he says, "I noticed it is small importance whether you call it plague or some rare kind of fever. The important thing is to prevent it killing off half the population of the town. If we call it plague," the other doctors argued, "people will cooperate with us." So they called it the plague. So what is hanging on calling people migrants? What do we mean by the term? Usually, the question's answered with recourse to definitions, and as a scholar, an American scholar, I always go to the Oxford English Dictionary, which demonstrates, I think, the limits of words. It's a person on a journey. Many of us in this room are migrants right now. Or it's a person who moves temporarily or seasonally from place to place, often for work. Turning towards actual uses, the word migrant often comes with a modifier like wretched or unhappy or unwanted. Usually migrants are unwanted. So I'm going to suggest that in order to figure out what a migrant is, we actually have to start looking at photographs that we think of as photographs of migrants. So here is the mother of all migrant photographs, the migrant mother, the iconic migrant photograph. But actually, I've already been just testing definitions of migrants against pictures. We know migrants through iconography more than we know them through definitions. This particular iconography stems from images of charity, and in turn, it becomes the model for some other images of migrants who are lately usually also termed refugees. When we talk about migrant these days, we often mean, most of the time, refugees. There are, of course, not just this trope, but other tropes of the migrant refugee. And the refugee child is, I think, one of the main ones. And a refugee has a better definition in the Oxford English Dictionary, something that's a little more descriptive. It's a person who's been forced to leave his or her home and seek refuge elsewhere, especially in a foreign country, from war, religious persecution, political troubles, the effects of natural disaster, a displaced person. These are the kinds of pictures that we identify with, refugees and migrants. They've acquired their own unflattering name, refugee porn, but I think of them as equivalent to the word migrant. For me, the word migrant has come to mean someone who is photographed as a migrant. Photographs of migrant are tautological. They tell you nothing about the migrant in question, but they seem to offer up the whole person to some sort of sacrificial naming ritual. These photographs of this sort help create and perpetuate the categories and their connotations. As deconstructionists and others taught us long ago, the language in which we try to say anything new often perpetuates the category we are trying to dissolve by saying that new thing. It's difficult to step out of a discourse. This is also true of photographic discourses as well as discourses in words, which I think is amply shown by Anna's first talk in trying to get, trying to use agency to get people out of a familiar discourse. But photographs come about differently from words. As I think we all realize, they involve the scene of photography, how what happens there creates the pictures we see and the categories that it represents. My thoughts today come from my work in Palestine. I'm involved in mainly two projects: murals and streetscapes in Palestinian refugee camps, and photographic practices in the context of struggles over land in the explicitly Israeli-controlled area of the West Bank, Area C. A group of activists called Ta'ayish is trying to help Palestinians and Bedouins in the West Bank keep their homes and their lands in the face of evictions by Israeli occupation authorities in cooperation with Israeli settlers. The two locations offer interesting contrasts. People living in the refugee camps are officially refugees. But for the most part, they were born exactly where they live. And the camps look like the poorer areas in cities. Whereas people living in their own threatened villages live in tents and sometimes in small aluminum shacks. These people are trying to stay put. They live in tents because periodically their homes are demolished and the land is taken. They set up nearby and other places on their own lands, but the occupation authorities do not allow them to build permanent structures. Pictures of them and their villages tend to make them look more like migrants, people in refugee camps, as we think of refugee camps because of the iconography that we normally see. So last January, in one of these villages, the Bedouin village Umm al-Khair in South Hebron, one of the activists is standing at the entrance to a tin shed of a home, taking a picture of a barefoot little girl with his cell phone. He's pointing his phone in her direction. She looks up at him. I started going with Ta'ayush 3 years ago to look at the scene of photography, to examine how people use cameras for a social purpose. Officially, I should just let that happen. But I find by now my goal has become secondary, so rather than watch this photographic transaction, I intervene. I put my hands on both of his shoulders and press, and I say, get down, get down. Of course, sir, he immediately thinks we're being attacked, which we could be. But in fact, I'm just trying to prevent him from taking a picture like the ones that I just showed a few minutes ago. He figures out I'm trying to help him make a good picture. So as an academic, he's still holding his mobile phone like a book, but he stoops down and takes his picture. And then he shows it to me and says, well, it's still not a very good picture. But of course, I wasn't trying to help him make an aesthetically good picture. I was trying to help him make an ethically good picture. This probably all seems self-explanatory. It's easy to answer with reference to those pictures I just showed, but to me it seems like there's more to be explained and sorted out, and it points to the way that I'm struggling to study photography through practice, I guess a kind of participatory anthropology in a certain way of photographic practices. So for some years, I've been trying to conceive photography as a set of relational practices. The book that was just Costanza just explained so beautifully, is part of that practice. It was an attempt to talk about photography as a social actor, but the book concentrated maybe more on how photographs are used as substitutes for people in the photographs by arranging them, sending them. I won't repeat all of the sorts of photographical post-photography transactions that are being made. How those things are done affects the kind of attention that people give to photographs. For example, I discussed the way people bask in photographs in large crowded exhibitions. Conversely, if you put one picture in a locket, it might be very small and you might never look at it, but it looms very large nevertheless. And in between are, for example, photographs in family albums. I did discuss how people take photographs, particularly in relationship to photographic empowerment projects. But even here, I tended to leave out the people in the photographs. I dealt with a relationship between a professional photographer and a homeless boy whom he was helping to take photographs, but they were taking pictures of another homeless boy whose position in the photographs and whose relationship to them I really left out. So I was after something different when I pushed my friend down to get to photograph a little girl instead of photographing her from above. I was dealing on the spot with photography as a transaction that results in photographs, not with the photographs themselves or how they were used. The physical relationship between the two bodies, the cell phone photographer and the little girl, was what I had in mind. You know, you can do this, I said. You take delightful snapshots of your grandchildren, and they never come out looking like one of those pictures. So lately, I've been trying to think not about how photography is used to form relationships, but how relationships are used to form photographs. And I think of a photograph then as a form of relationship. Instead of the attention to the photograph, I want to think of the photograph as a form of attention or attentiveness. And it comes out of my thinking lately about photography and imagination, which I'll try to discuss a little bit here. Imagination is a chameleon-like term. There can be translation problems, and in English, it's interchangeability with a word like fantasy confuses all attempts to pin it down. A concept like imagination has been used and viewed in different ways in the last couple hundred years, the period in most relevant maybe to photography. One view has it that imagination is the active component of vision. It turns spots of color into real things that we can not only see but also recognize. In this view, imagination in an active sense has a positive epistemological role to play. It's extended to photography, this role often makes photographs seem like purveyors of visual truth. But sometimes imagination is viewed, while still active, in a negative sense. It's an alien force that comes from outside and is likely to confuse and raise havoc. This disruptive imagination might be seen as literally having been planted by an outsider, as indeed sometimes it is in literature or in the Bible. Think of the power of suggestion. So it even happens in so-called real life. The deception caused by the seemingly true image can cause very real effects, however. I found Jean-Paul Sartre useful in trying to articulate my concept of imagination as a form of relation connected with seeing. In his appropriately titled L'Imaginaire, Sartre argued that a mental image is nothing other than a relationship. He coined a term, imaging consciousness, conscience imaginant, to denote the consciousness one has of an object or person whom one is imagining. He wanted to see the word image to denote the type of attention one might direct toward an object, an imagination or imaging consciousness, to characterize the act that seems to produce a mental image. He rejected a kind of common sense notion of imagination, as which I haven't even mentioned, as a storage place where perceptions live on, perhaps dwindled and faded. Imagination, rather, is an act, or rather a process for Sartre. He extended to imagination Henri Bergson's idea that experience should be conceived in terms of active temporal rather than static spatial concepts. If I'm thinking of someone, my attention is not directed towards an image in my mind, but toward a person, which for Sartre is usually someone named Pierre, who is always in Berlin. The imaging process consists in this attentive relation, and the process itself could be called imagining. Imagining, then, is distinct from perceiving directly, but inseparable from taking an attitude toward what one is seeing. Sartre thought that when imaging, we stand back and distance ourselves from the immediate present. For Sartre, the imagination was never planted from the outside. It came from an internal site of complete freedom, apart from real life. The exigencies of immediate perception. It happens in that moment when we are able to step back and envision something in a generalized sense. Because imagination deals with relationship and attention rather than facts, it can't be mistaken or coerced. Hence, it represents for Sartre not just one way, but for the quintessential way in which humans experience freedom. Well, this is a notion of imagination and attention that I think relates to the art world, where the nature of looking is usually encompassed by words like gazing and beholding, words that signal detachment, even when they denote devotion.
So I'm going to reject that aspect of Sartre and borrow from him, primarily the idea of imagination as an activity, a form of attentive behavior. But I want to speculate that, well, the factor of distance can make imagination appear at times as though it comes from within, it also comes from a place outside of oneself. And I might just add here, because I only thought of it this second, it comes from a place of discourse, generally. Both notions of imagination coming from a place of freedom from within or a place of coercion from without, and any number of variations on them are compatible, however, with an active notion of imagination. And the notion of an ambiguous origin of imagination, the moment of freedom struggling with the moment of discourse, potentially makes it applicable to photography. Photography is alternatively seen as the reproduction of an outer reality or the effect of an interpretation coming from within the photographer. This conflict has been behind many arguments about photography's status as an art. To think of photography as a relation, however, suggests ways in which photography is both external and internal. We may think we are photographing people we see outside of ourselves, but we're really photographing our relationship to these people mixed with their relation to us. Ours and their relations are forms of attention, or what I'm calling forms of attention, literally forms. The role of imagination in photographic practices, like the role of imagination outside of photography, is to turn attentiveness as a practice into a form or image of the relationship between the watcher and whatever or whomever that person is watching. Considered this way, photography pertains less to an external subject that is photographed than to the type of attention one might direct toward that subject. But how will the forms of attention that photographers give to their subjects and their subjects give back shape photographs? As shaped attention, photography can actually be a kind of disruptive imagination coming from the outside. And this project has run me directly up the uncomfortable dissonance between academic research, photography, and engagement. This is because attention is actually a measure of engagement. If notions of attention are ways of conceiving looking, we can distinguish different kinds of looking in terms of the extent and nature of the engagement that they entail. Engagement not just of the photographer, but the person on the other side of the camera. Or in the case I started with, the person watching the trauma victim, threatened child, or refugee, migrant. Now, you always think these thoughts start, you know, just when you think them up, but my thoughts maybe really started with a consideration of a looking that began with picking up something that I did a long time ago. For the last few years, I've been thinking and talking about a group of photographs I took decades ago, of the very first major gay rights rally in Chicago. I took pictures of the rally, but I concentrated on the bystanders. I used these photographs to think about various terms for looking, watching, onlooking, witnessing, as ways to describe different ways of relating visually to ongoing events. I tried to parse out the fluid relationship between the onlooker who might have started as a bystander, someone who happens to be around at the time, that is, but lacks any tie to events, or someone who might have started as an onlooker or might have been there on purpose, like a policeman who might be watching, or the army, or if the event is dire enough, someone from the appropriately named Human Rights Watch. Any of these might become a participant, and there might be witnesses as well. We might think of witnessing as a kind of participatory looking that mostly happens afterwards when one tells the story or shows one's photographs. As I read these photographs, what I didn't think about or speak about in those 3 years of talks about it was the nature of my own engagement. People keep asking me various versions of questions about it, like, why didn't I make a selfie? Which to me seemed like one of the more ridiculous questions that I ever been asked. I said, well, no, I'm not in any of the photographs, although the only other photographer
that was there was probably he was there for the police and what was called the Red Squad at the time. But I did say that, I mean, in one sense, I'm of course in every one because the photographs are my interpretation of the event and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I didn't tend to read into the photographs because the photographs were my reading, I said. I made an interpretation or imagined the scene in part by visually analyzing the relationship between my subjects, which I thought was quite interesting. But some of them, I have to say, I enacted. That is, I used my own active relations with my subjects. To make a photograph is to enact it. To get involved in the scene. Reading a scene to take a photograph is not the same as reading a book or a photograph either. Because the author of the book, as Socrates already pointed out in Plato's dialogue Phaedrus, the author of the book's not there in front of you. When you photograph, the subject is right there in front of you. Photographer may seem to capture something that went by, and the subsequent interpretation of the photograph is often the interpretation of that event. But in fact, the camera operates through its relationship to its subject. My camera was not that different from the poses of the onlookers, bystanders, and participants. My camera was a gesture like theirs. To get these women's look, I had to become the target of that look. She was watching the marchers, and in fact, I had to be in the march to get them looking at me. To get these guys to glare at me, I had to put myself between them and the demonstrators. So when I talk about attention, I'm not just talking my attention, but also their attention. Taking the pictures was a relational act in a very literal way of the imaging consciousness. Since I didn't show or publish the photographs, however, it stayed, for all intents and purposes, in my imagination. So back to the organization, to Ayush, where I've been involved in a photographic practice of watching and counter-watching. To Ayush accompanies farmers and shepherds to their fields to keep them from being attacked by Israeli settlers who are trying to harass them into leaving the land. It's not all they do, but that's what they do that involves cameras. I was struck with the prominence of cameras in their work, and so my idea was to photograph the people using cameras and to think about the process, beginning with a series of blogs about watching. But I began to see my role in research practice differently. Here's the beginning of a scene where we are accompanying farmers who are replanting with new olive trees an olive grove that has been uprooted by Israeli settlers. This visit was my turning point, just someone planting an olive tree. So now we almost forgot that we, the watchers, were intended as the show here. At first, our audience was small, and this is really part of this is directly out of my blog, only one soldier. In the game of watching, I figured we're, 10 to 1. There didn't seem to be much to do, so I set my camera down. I was feeling quite useless, as I often did in that early time, and I asked a farmer what I could do to help with olive planting. The answer was, you just make photographs. So I assumed it meant something like, go play, child. And but as I turned to do just that with everyone else, who was kind of sitting around doing nothing, he motioned and called me back, no. I mean, look, there are more soldiers. You must photograph. To me, my photography seemed fruitless, but the farmer had a vision of what could be accomplished with my camera. I don't know whether he had photographs in mind as an end result, but he understood better than I that the practice of photography is a form of extended, intensified watching. Photographic watching can be terrifying to those on the other side of the lens. The settlers might imagine that the camera sees farther than the human eye and that its image will live to testify about what it saw. Meanwhile, those watching or farming acquire courage. From that moment, I knew that my field research had become about my own practice of photography. I have to talk about it through the results and through narrative, but the photographs are perhaps not the main point. The photographing is. The photographs themselves
make it a focus for talking about the process. So I photographed the soldiers and the settlers, and I continued to do so. After this set where people were throwing rocks, I bought a really good 400 millimeter long lens. But ultimately, I ended up in more or less the same situation, depicting relations by being in them, as I had in the gay liberation photographs. And indeed, deflecting attention to myself was part of the strategy. In fact, it's Taiyusha's strategy. Here the attention was intended for my comrade with a pen and notebook. And this image from a post from last January is a transactional photograph engaging in equal measure the attention of my subject to me, whom he's trying patiently to explain in the most patronizing form possible that I should not be taking photographs, that it was impolite. Notice that we answered, of course, that the bulldozer digging up Palestinian land was also impolite. And it's not a particularly friendly sort of attention. As was recognized, this is probably me in a still from a quote-unquote expose of Taiyush by a far-right group. It's a video, so of course it's accompanied by scare music. It's also a stealth photograph, since I didn't know that it was being taken, although I see on my images now who took it and where. I could say something about stealth photography here, but maybe I'll do that later if we have time. But back to photographing the little children in the threatened village. If the very concepts of migrants or refugees, like photography, are formed by qualities of attention, then if we ask what differentiates a migrant from, say, an emigre, or an immigrant, someone who simply moved, we might come up with the idea that it's the form of attention paid to one as opposed to the others. If photography is a form of attention, then to be photographed as a migrant is central to being one. This pertains to a village like Susia in the South Hebron Hills, where the people lend themselves to being photographed as migrants and refugees simply because they live in tents and they have cute children. But since such attention defines the person, then photographing someone as a migrant can turn them into one. They look like they need to be resettled, and arguments depending on this idea are consistently made by Israeli government officials. How does one attend to a person whom you're photographing in order to avoid such thoughts? The short answer, of course, is with respect. At one time, I thought that Walker Evans' famous photograph of the tenant's farmer's wife accomplished this. You look at back, you know? Very simple. Both of them are looking at each other. She's so open. She's so brave and honest. But actually thinking about it right now is, why does she have to be so brave exactly? Was the camera and Walker Evans some kind of threat? So maybe the answer I was looking for was to contradict this kind of notion and let a relationship emerge from the effort of a photograph. To photograph people not with kind of generalized notion of respect, but to photograph people insofar as maybe they belonged where they were. I want to end with this idea so that this can entail, I want to end with the idea that this can entail the freedom, say, not to look back, because you actually trust what the photographer is doing when you're not looking at them. So Taiyush it's a wonderful group, but mainly it's a man's world. To get to know the women of the South Hebron Hills, I had to stray away from the group. And when I wandered alone in Susia, I met women and girls who were anxious to show me places like the electrical station and invited me into their tents. Later, because the village is constantly under the threat of destruction, a friend asked me to illustrate his plea to save it. Since he wrote about his friendship with the men, the improvements they had accomplished, how they had built this and that in this male way, like the green electricity that they introduced with the help of an NGO, because they're not allowed on the electric grid. Well, I decided I would illustrate his story with photographs of women and girls. And so these girls who are writing their names from me. Girls, you know, writing, not looking helplessly up. And I also made an effort to try to see the town of Susia, which has offices and gardens, rather than the Susia of tents and refuse. So there was only one image that was a stealth image, so I'm getting to the stealth image, also towards the end here. The woman at the right said, "Don't take pictures," she said. "I don't want my mother on Facebook." But I did, of her and her mother in the village shop. Then, of course, I wanted to use it for this same post. So I emailed her. I sent her the picture and told her about the purpose for which I wanted to use it. "Oh, I like that picture. You can use it and for that purpose. Perfect. Great idea." And that led to a request that I come and photograph her women, their women's group, which met to work out ways in which women could contribute to village economies. They embraced all the women of the different villages of the South Hebron Hills. They talked about education, minor industries like yogurt making and spinning.
So I did.
But I want to focus about the girl in the middle of this picture, just briefly. That girl looking up in a plaintive way is not read as objecting to her condition, pleading with the viewer to send money to Amnesty International, or to be an example of a victim. Probably this girl just wants to know when this boring meeting is going to be over. Now, she may think that the meeting is being prolonged so I can get my picture. And in fact, maybe it is. The photographs were, along with anything else, the image of a kind of attention that we were giving or not giving one another as we focused on a joint project. I just want to compare this with an image of the same girl by a different photographer so you get the sense of what plaintive looks can mean or not mean. So in one sense, the joint project that I was involved with was the effort to build a women's group, but it was also about my effort to get to know the women and about their effort to be recognized as an active group. So I guess that my talk has, in a sense, been about agency as much as it has been about attention and the ways in which it plays into photographic efforts, and I hope that you will help me think about this in any minutes that remain, as well as I'm sure you will in the rest of the conference.